I'd like to tell you about a book that I think is an absolute must-read for those in church leadership.
Welcome to the Craig T. Owens Audio Blog, with Craig's blog posts in audio format to go. Now, here's Craig.
The book that I'm talking about is Desizing the Church by Carl Vaters. I loved this book. I was privileged to get an advanced copy from Carl, and I was highlighting and circling and underlining, and I was texting my other pastor friends and saying, oh, you got to check this out or listen to what Carl said here. It is a eye-opening, mind-opening book, and I hope that people in church leadership will pick this up and really devour it. I was also privileged to be able to sit down with Carl for a few minutes and talk about his book and ask him a few questions. Check out our interview. Well, Carl, I'm glad that we can have this time together. I'm not sure if I shared this with you before, but I became really aware of some of your ideas that you unpack in this new book before I ever had a chance to meet you. I was being interviewed by a couple of guys, and we're kind of on the commercial in the podcast. One of the guys says to me, goes, hey, have you ever hung out with Carl Vaters? I said, no, I mean, I know who that is. But no, we've never really hung out. And he said to his co-host, he goes, doesn't he sound a lot like Carl? Like it's the same kind of ideas, the same kind of passion. And so then I'm like, well, I gotta, you know, what am I missing here? And so while I'm like poking around on your website, right around that same time, then you reached out to me and said, hey, somebody gave me a copy of your book, and you and I are kind of on the same wavelength here. So,
oh, wow.
So I was really excited then when this new book came out, and thanks for sending me an advanced copy. I was so excited to dive into this thing, but I want to start with the title, because right at the beginning, you know, we're not supposed to, like the cliche says, don't judge the book by the cover. But I'm afraid that some people, if they just see the title Desizing and they're a church leader, they might go, well, wait a minute, this sounds counterintuitive. So unpack a little bit. Yeah. What does that title mean?
Yeah, it's only been out a week or so now, but that title has already been kind of like the topic of conversation. I actually talked to somebody the other day. He said, yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine, and he's pastoring this church, and he can't get his numbers up, and he's getting frustrated. So I told him, you know, I just read an advanced copy of Desizing the Church. You need to read Desizing the Church. And he said, my friend paused and went, yeah, just that title is ticking me off enough that I probably don't need to read it. Desizing is I kind of made it up. I don't know that it's really an official word, but let me first start by saying what it's not. Desizing is not downsizing,
right?
So we are not talking about, I don't have any desire for churches to be small. I love the small church. I do a lot of work with small church pastors. I try to find small church specific resources whenever I can, but there's no right size for a church, and I don't want churches to be smaller. The idea of desizing is the idea of removing size as the primary factor by which we judge congregations. Because let's be honest, 40 years and counting, every time pastors meet, the main thing we talk about is how many people we have in the church on any given Sunday. Yep. And that is the requisite determiner of whether or not a church is healthy. If it's getting bigger, it must be healthy. If it's getting smaller, it must be unhealthy. But there are a whole bunch of other factors at play that we need to take consideration. It's not even removing numbers from the equation. I think numbers are important, but they shouldn't be the most important thing, or sometimes the only thing that we consider.
Well, I like too the way that you made a little kind of analogy in passing about the shoe size related to church size. Share that.
Yeah, I'm 6'6", and in fact, in my first book, The Grasshopper Myth, I talk about a young girl at our church back in the day. She's now a young married mom, but back in the day, she thought that, you know, the bigger you were, the older you were, because at her age, when you get bigger, you get older, you get bigger. And then she paused and went, Pastor Carl must be the oldest person in the world. Because I was the tallest person she knew. And so her mom related that to me. And it was like, and sometimes we take that kind of immature approach to churches. Well, that's the biggest church around. It must be the healthiest church around. But in fact, what I've discovered through the years and working with so many pastors and so many sized churches is there does seem to be kind of a right fit. I know that for congregation members, there's a lot of them that are like, hey, I like a church of around this size because I can know everybody, or I like a church a little bit bigger because it has more programs or whatever. And I don't think that's something that we should dismiss too quickly. I do think that there are good size. I don't think there's a right size for the church in general, which I mentioned in Desizing the Church. But I do think there can be a right shoe size for certain situations, for certain periods of time, for certain types of ministry, for certain styles of pastoring. And we need to kind of be okay with the fact that right now, at least, God has me in this size of a church because right now, at least, this is my shoe size, and it may stay my shoe size for my entire time in ministry. And we need to be kind of okay with that.
Right. Especially if you're talking about maybe a pastor that's in a more of a rural or a farming community, and you know somebody's been pushing to him, you got to get bigger, bigger, bigger. And you're looking around going, there's no people that live, you know, in this area. So the right size for his church is the right size for his church, not some artificial number that, you know, you have to kind of steadily see the graph going up and to the right.
Yeah, so, yeah, exactly. And I use the term shoe size because nobody thinks that a foot should be getting bigger. Right. You know, there's a certain point where we reach it and go, that's just the size of shoe I'm going to wear. But that doesn't mean that I can't continue to grow as a person just because my shoe size isn't getting any bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, listen, those that are watching this, you see me nodding my head a lot. This is what was happening when I was reading Desizing. I just kept highlighting and just going, yes, yes, yes. I mean, it just, this whole book resonated with me. That's why I was so excited to be able to talk with you about it. But one of the things that kind of I found very fascinating is this idea of church growth, the kind of founder of the church growth movement, it's not what he intended. And you kind of do a history lesson there, which, to be honest with you, Carl, I had never heard that before. And, you know, you document it well and show what it was supposed to be, what the intention was there, and how it's sort of been hijacked in some places. Can you kind of set the record straight a little bit on that?
For sure. That's actually the genesis of the book. It was several years ago that I was on a podcast, and there were two guests on the podcast, me and Gary McIntosh. And Gary McIntosh, after that podcast, actually wrote the biography of Donald McGavran. And in that podcast, he talked about McGavran and said that McGavran's intent for the church growth movement was not what it became. So it's interesting because Donald McGavran is, I think, one of the most impactful ministers of the last 100 years. Mm-hmm. But he's almost disappeared from our radar, even by those who are in the church growth stream right now. But Donald McGavran is, by literally everybody's account, the father of the church growth movement. His book, The Bridges of God, was the first book in which the term church growth was used. He was the first one to say, hey, here are some of the questions we should be looking at when we're considering church growth and church impact. And if you take a look at the general conversations we have about church growth today, almost all of the ideas and even a lot of the vocabulary found its genesis in Donald McGavran. Now, because of that, for years, I thought, okay, Donald McGavran gets the credit for the good of the church growth movement, but that means he also needs to take the hits for the negatives. And because of McIntosh's conversation, he actually said, actually, McGavran's idea for the church growth movement was very different from where it's gone. So I did the research, and here's a quick, very quick recap of what takes two or three chapters in the book to unpack. McGavran was a missionary in India from the 30s through the late 60s. 1930s to the late 1960s. We're in a different century now.
I
need to make
sure. Crazy.
Yeah. And near the end of his time there, he started hearing reports of entire villages coming to faith in Christ all at once. And at first he thought, that can't be the case. It's got to be an exaggeration. But he went to check it out and found out, yeah, it's actually true. So he thought, I want to discover the principles behind this. And he started documenting it. And then as he retired, he did a tour in Africa where he'd heard that similar things were happening. So he went to several countries in Africa as well. He then came home and went back to his alma mater, actually at Yale University. And at Yale, he wrote his first book called The Bridges of God. And the premise of the title is, what are these bridges that connect people to God? And he published it and then started the Church Growth Institute at Fuller in the late 1960s. And for the first 8 years of the school, he would not allow American pastors to attend. Now, what's fascinating is you aren't allowed to just say American pastors can't show up. So what he did was he came up with three requirements that excluded 99.9% of us, which is you have to master a second language. You have to be working in a context outside of your own context in another ethnicity. And thirdly, you have to show mastery in your understanding of an ethnicity outside of your American context. So that excludes 99.9% of us. Mm-hmm. But American pastors were reading his book and going, hey, there's some really good stuff here. We want in the class too. So after 7 or 8 years of teaching it, he finally relented. And he, along with C. Peter Wagner, one of his primary students, taught the first class in 1972. And that is, by every single church historian's estimation, the spark that began the church growth movement in America. Now, why did he not want American pastors in it? And here's the real interesting thing that I lay out in the book and that I think really helps us understand where we are today. He didn't want that because he looked around and he saw Americans are obsessed with bigness. And his thought was, if American pastors get a hold of my ideas, they're not going to apply them into how do people movements come to Christ. They will turn it into a big church contest. Now, he didn't use the phrase big church contest, and I don't even use the phrase in my book because that's just too incendiary.
Right.
But that's kind of what it is. I travel through the South a lot lately, and I'm convinced there's a big cross contest going on in some states. There's these massive crosses, and it seems, I just heard the other day of some other church wanting to put up like a 130-foot cross on their property. Like, why? I don't get it. Anyway, so we like big things and we like winning. And so he thought they're going to turn it into a big church contest. And his idea wasn't bigger churches. His idea was people movements coming to Christ. And that, in fact, he knew that the best way for that to happen is actually the multiplication of smaller churches more than it is the building of larger ones. But sure enough, when we got his ideas, we applied his vocabulary and some of his underlying principles into this idea of bigger is better. And they became fused into this thing that became the church growth movement. But in fact, it was kind of two different streams combining in a way that McGavran never intended.
Well, and that's what I found fascinating, because there were so many paradigms that I have about church growth that I never would have questioned before. And then when you laid out that history, then all of a sudden I was like, oh my goodness. And you kind of go back to where it started. You said, boy, we really got off track on this thing, because, you know, like we said at the outset, it has just become, just got to get bigger, 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 bigger all the time without even thinking through what are you doing to make it bigger? You know, it might not even be God honoring if you're just pursuing numbers just for the sake of numbers. So I thought that history was just so eye-opening, because I never really thought of from his concept or his construct before on how, you know, we have departed from that. But as you go through the book, you talk about, you know, you got the church growth, and you talk about kind of three waves. And I'm going to read one paragraph here, because you talk about the revivals, and some of the key figures that people would see in there. And then you talk about how after that comes about some strategizing, like, okay, so now let's kind of formulaic on this if we can a little bit. And then the push for activism in the church. You got to take a stand for something. And as you make the transition, I love this quote, because it really made me stop here. And I underlined, circled this one a lot. So what's the answer? This is what you wrote. Do we need a new revival? Yes. Better strategies? For sure. Passion for important causes? Absolutely. But this is the important part. They all pale when compared to one aspect of life that provides the foundation on which anything of lasting value is built: integrity. Integrity. Yeah. Now, I think a lot of people give lip service to the word integrity, but talk about what you mean here in the concept of the whole paradigm of desizing. What do you mean by integrity for our church leaders?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked the question, because that really is the crux of the book. Like I said, we've had these waves come through. The revivalism wave, I saw that, I experienced that in the 60s and 70s. And then the strategizing wave, where we had, you know, folks like John Maxwell and others who gave great ideas and principles. And in fact, I would include Donald McGavran as one of the strategizers as well. And today we've got activism. We've got people on both the left and the right demanding that the pastor fly their sometimes literal flag, whether it's MAGA on one side or it's an LGBTQ flag on the other side, left or right. There's this insistence in activism. And whether you are an activist or a revivalist or a strategist, if you're not doing it with integrity, it doesn't matter. If you're willing to compromise your values in order to, quote unquote, win some kind of contest, then it doesn't matter. So the chapter you're referencing is actually entitled Integrity is the New Competence. Mm-hmm. And the reason I use that phrase and use that title for that chapter is for 40 years now, we've been trying to improve our churches by one of those three things. And I think the strongest one has probably been strategizing. We've gone to conference after conference after conference to learn new methods, new ideas, new strategies to figure out how to make our church a little bit better. Or maybe you're on the revival end of things and you're going to, you know, things trying to get your church revived again. Or maybe, again, you're on the activist end of things and you just think if we can get the right number of people voting the right way, then we can turn the church around and turn the country around. But none of that works if we're doing it without integrity. And here's the other part of it that really, I think, clicks for me. There's a lot of conversation right now about ex-evangelicals or de-churching or people who are no longer in the faith, who are deconstructing their faith, whichever term you want to use. But you cannot talk to a single person who says they're deconstructing their faith or who is currently an ex-evangelical. You can't find one person who says, the reason I left the church was because they couldn't get their strategies right. Right. That I wanted to serve Jesus, but my church just wasn't getting any bigger. So what am I to believe? Yeah. Right. But you will find a whole lot of them who left because they don't trust us anymore. Because we've had a lack of integrity. Yeah. So we cannot strategize our way out of this mess. We can't even revive our way out of this mess. We can only get out of this mess by being people who are trustworthy, by being people of integrity, by living as people of character. Mm-hmm. That's what underlies everything. And the lack of that is what's damaging people. It's what is creating all kinds of victims, not imagined victims, but actual victims. When we lack character, we victimize people in all kinds of different ways. Yes. And sometimes it's our leaders, and sometimes it's the people who are trying to follow our leaders. And sometimes it's both. Sometimes the lack of character in the leader ends up hurting everybody, including the leader themselves.
Absolutely.
We have to get back to, we have assumed integrity and we've been teaching competence, and we cannot assume integrity anymore.
I love that line. We assumed integrity. And I think that there's a lot of people that they just have been kind of on the carousel, that this is just the way that we do it, just the way we do it. And there's been no like pausing to look like, why are we doing this? What's at the heart of this? What's at my heart, you know, as a pastor, as a ministry leader, what's really at the heart of why I'm doing what I'm doing? And again, I mean, I'm going to repeat myself. I can't tell you how many times that as I was reading, I'm underlying something. I'm sending texts to some of my fellow pastors. I'm like, I just got to share this with somebody else. Has got to hear this. It is such a needed book. And Carl, what would you say? And I don't even know if you can. I don't know. I could sum it up, but you were the author. Maybe you could. What would you want, like a pastor or a ministry leader, when they walk away from this book, what do you want the takeaway to be? What do you want to have happen in their hearts and their minds?
Yeah, I want them to be able to know The one thing we touched on was the integrity. The other real key turning point, there are two chapters that actually make the turn in the book from here are the challenges and here's why they're difficult for us. And the one is integrity and the other one is discipleship. Mm-hmm. The discipleship chapter is entitled Discipleship Fixes Everything. And I want people to listen to that and pause. Yes, I mean to be that in your face with those three words. And I am absolutely convinced discipleship literally fixes everything. I want you to think of a problem in your church that discipleship will not fix. Mm. Right? Lack of finances, discipleship will fix that. Lack of maturity, discipleship will fix that. Conflict, immorality, disunity. You cannot name a problem in the church that discipleship is not the remedy for, which is why Jesus told us, build disciples. Meanwhile, he said he will build his church.
Right. Yep.
But what we do is we've decided, okay, Jesus, I'll take the building the church part. We're constantly trying to build the church, and I'm convinced Jesus keeps going, no, stop. I'll build the church.
Right.
You make disciples. My friend Peyton Jones, who wrote Church Plantology, he talks about this a lot. He says we've got this idea of planting churches, that if we plant churches, then we'll make disciples. And he said, no, make disciples, and when you make disciples, churches will get planted.
Yes.
And we've gotten it backwards. So if a pastor's going to walk away with anything, that's what I want them to walk away with. Stop trying to build the church. That's Jesus' job, and he's really, really good at it. You make disciples. That's the one assignment he gave us to do. And making disciples will fix all of the problems in your church. Actually, there's only one problem making disciples won't fix, and that is the size of your church, for two reasons. One, because the size of your church is not a problem to fix. And secondly, because there will be times, if you choose to consistently make disciples, there will be times when you've got the choice between doing something that will make your church bigger or doing something that will make disciples, and you can't do both at the same time. And we need to pre-decide that when we come to that point where we have to decide between bigger or character, or we have to decide between bigger or disciple making, we will pick character and we will pick disciple making every single time.
Yes. Amen. It's great.
Yeah.
So the book's available. People can get it on Amazon, and I'm sure other online resources as well.
Wherever books are sold, as they say.
Great. But there's also, you have ongoing resources as well, ongoing conversations with church leaders. Share with the folks where they can connect with you on that.
Yeah, absolutely. CarlVaders.com is my website. So that's where you can go for anything that I do. The nice thing about having a name, if you spell my name correctly, which can be a challenge at times, Carl with a K, Vaders starting with a V with a T in the middle, and make sure you add the S at the end.
If
you
can get my name right.
Yeah. If you can get my name right, you can find me anywhere, including on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and all that place. But CarlVaders.com is the clearinghouse for everything I do.
Yep. A great podcast. Good conversations on there. So there's a lot of places. So get to Carl's website. And, you know, Pastor, listen, I strongly recommend not only to pick up a copy of Desizing for yourself, but get it for your other ministry leaders, get it for your board, get it for your associate staff members. Read this together, discuss it together, because I think that you're going to have a lot of eye-opening aha moments, a lot of things where you're going, man, our paradigms are being challenged here. And it'd be good if you all were kind of on that journey of discovery together. So this is going to be a book that I really hope, Carl, that, and I've been praying for this book, that it's going to open some eyes that people have just been so, you know, they've been going and not realizing what it is that they're pursuing or why they're pursuing it. And this is going to really kind of just cause them for a second to go, well, wait a minute, hold on. What exactly are we going after here? So believing for great things for this book. So kudos to you for writing
you,
this excellent resource.
I appreciate it very, very much. Thank you.
You bet. Please make sure that you pick up a copy of Desizing the Church by Carl Vaders as soon as you can.
To get in touch with Craig, to read more posts, or to access the huge library of resources Craig has compiled, go to CraigTOwens.com.